Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's Monday, and this is The Takeaway for June 24th.
The children are dirty, they're sick, they're being detained for long periods of time, and they're hungry.
An immigration lawyer describes what she saw when she visited children being held at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Some of the children are given a thin blanket or sheet to sleep with, but as punishment, sometimes those blankets and sheets are taken away.
How the U.S. immigration system treats children. Also on the show, the Black community in South Bend reacts to Mayor Pete Buttigieg's handling of a police shooting.
There's a saying that if you don't practice what you preach, then what you preach is only a speech and it won't reach.
And the controversy over video replay in the Women's World Cup. Plus, we have our first part in our new series, Life After Overdose.
And I remember thinking that we would have all been better off, and especially her, if she had just died during that first overdose.
A lot to get to, folks, but we start in Texas.
When I interview children in detention, I try to sit close to them because we're talking about such sensitive and traumatic subjects. But with some of the children, I had trouble sitting near them because of the stench.
That's immigration attorney Alora Mukherjee. She spent last week talking to children in a Customs and Border Protection detention facility in Clint, Texas.
Many of the children have not been able to shower or bathe once since crossing the border, so I met with children who hadn't bathed for more than 3 weeks. None of the children have opportunities to change their clothes on a regular basis. Nearly every child I met with is wearing the same clothing that they crossed the border in, and their clothing is stained in bodily fluids. There's nasal mucus on their clothes. Breastfeeding teenage moms have shirts that are covered in breast milk stains. And very young children who aren't being given diapers as they need have urine on their pants. It is disgusting.
There are more than 300 children in the Clint CBP detention facility. Under a 1997 law known as the Flores Settlement, the government is supposed to provide the children with, quote, safe and sanitary conditions, and they are not supposed to hold migrant children for more than 72 hours. Mukherjee says that some children told her they had been in detention for weeks, and the conditions were anything but safe and sanitary.
The children do not have access to soap to wash their hands, and as a result, viruses are spreading very quickly through the facility. There is a flu outbreak. Children there are in quarantine. We begged repeatedly to get access to that quarantine, and officials denied us our numerous requests. The children are dirty, they're sick, they're being detained for long periods of time, and they're hungry.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. As thousands of migrant children remain in government detention, many Americans want to know how the U.S. immigration system reached this point and the work that needs to be done to improve conditions in detention centers across the country. To get context and history, I spoke with David Hernandez, an associate professor of Latino studies at Mount Holyoke College, and we were also joined by Alora Mukherjee, the lawyer who was part of a team that visited the children in Clint, Texas. She's also a professor and the director of the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law.
The sleeping conditions in the Clint facility are not appropriate for children. Many of the children don't even have mats to sleep on. There are no beds. They're sleeping on the concrete floors. At times, some of the children are given a thin blanket or sheet to sleep with, but as punishment, sometimes those blankets and sheets are taken away.
Punishment for what?
So on Wednesday evening, a member of our team learned that there were 20 girls in one holding cell, and that two of the girls apparently had a lice infestation, and they were given two lice combs and told to comb everyone's hair, which you're not supposed to do with lice, right? You're not supposed to share combs, but they were told to share combs. Apparently, one of the combs became lost and the children couldn't find it. And as punishment for not being able to find the combs, the sheets, the blankets, and the mats that the children were supposed to be sleeping on were all taken away. And I should mention that it is extremely cold in many of these holding cells at night, and the children cannot sleep. Many of them have told me that they are so hungry, they wake up at night multiple times with hunger pangs.
Why are they not eating?
There is insufficient food for the children, and the quality of the food is not a good quality. Children are given the same food, regardless of if they're 1 year old or 17 years old. Everyone is provided with the same tray. And there are no fresh fruits, there are no vegetables, there's no milk, and there is no age-appropriate or caloric appropriate assessment going on. So breastfeeding mothers who need extra calories to provide milk for their babies are being given the same amount of food as a 1 year old. A 2 year old is given the same size tray as a 17 year old.
Legally, at least, Customs and Border Protection is not allowed to hold minors for longer than 72 hours. You're saying some of these minors have been there for 3 weeks without bathing or more. Did CBP respond to why these children were being held for longer than the legal limit?
CBP has not responded on that particular issue, as far as I know. But after the media story started breaking last Thursday, Friday, and over the weekend, CBP did issue a statement. And what is striking about CBP's statement is that they are not denying what the children have told us. What their statement says is that CBP is not designed to hold children for these long periods of time.
David, the 1997 Flores settlement was supposed to govern the treatment of migrant children in government custody. Let's talk a little bit about what conditions were like for migrant children before Flores.
I mean, Flores came out because of a case in the 1980s, and then it was litigated for a while. And in 1997, they settled and they decided that the best interest of the child and to try to process them out of these situations. But prior to that, they could either be mixed with adults in adult facilities, they could sit in offices, locked up in cubicles and offices while they're waiting. And so that there was a lot of change because of Flores. And then after 2014, when the family started coming together, I mean, Flores was originally for unaccompanied children. And then they started applying under Obama, and because of certain rulings, although they fought that, they started applying Flores to families as well. So children with their parents in detention would have limits to that detention as well. That's the 20-day limit in family detention. But I think the squalor that Professor Mukherjee is describing, and the lack of medical treatment, and the bungled medical treatment, and the indifference to the detainees, you know, that runs across the system. You know, that whether you're in CBP custody, whether you're in HHS custody, whether you're in ICE custody. This is an across-the-board condition for all these persons.
I want to pivot for a minute to a bit of a historical point, David. We know that one pivotal point for immigration policy here in the United States was after the wave of Haitian immigration in the 1970s. Can you help us understand what precedent that established for what we're seeing today?
I think the 70s and 80s, the Haitian case, along with Cubans, but especially with Haitians. Haitians were used as a sort of a laboratory to test out brand new policies, you know, including interdiction at sea, the use of mandatory detention, mass hearings, and then whatever rationale followed those, you know, supported those treatments. And so those very specific policies by the Carter and then Reagan administration, they are now the status quo policies nationally. And so those initial innovations became regularized policy that we consider normal today. And then they became ensconced in legislation in 1996 and after, and other policies of ICE and the INS before that.
And David, how did these immigration policies expand under Presidents Bush and subsequently President Obama?
I mean, as we know with Bush, we have 9/11. And then so there's a huge expansion and a new rationale in terms of anti-terrorism for detaining people. Central American migrants and Mexican migrants and people coming from Latin America, you know, generally aren't in that category. But the policies that restricted their rights and their access to relief from detention and deportation that were used against supposed terrorists were also used against the everyday migrant as well. So that expanded greatly under Bush. You know, he had workplace raids. He began family detention. You know, he had a family detention facility in Texas, the Hutto facility, which eventually was ended under Obama. And then Obama, as we know, becomes the deporter in chief. You know, deporting 1,000 people a day, up to 400,000 people in 2012. And so, and along with every one of those persons, they were detained prior to that, largely. And so the detention expansion just ballooned, you know, because of that. But all that was set up by legally making that possible in 1996, and then innovating on that in the late 70s and early 80s.
I want to play a clip from a Department of Justice lawyer who argued before the Ninth Circuit about sleeping on concrete floors, not providing toothbrushes, et cetera. Let's take a listen.
It's within everybody's common understanding that, you know, if you don't have a toothbrush, if you don't have soap, if you don't have a blanket, it's not safe and sanitary. Well, wouldn't everybody agree to that? Do you agree to that?
Well, I think there's fair reason to find that those things may be part of safe and sanitary.
Maybe are a part.
Laura, what does this argument tell us about where the federal government policy is right now?
The federal government's position, as demonstrated by that Ninth Circuit argument last week, is that children do not need toothbrushes, soap, places to sleep where they can actually get some rest. And the effect of that position is what we see in Clint. There is an emergency humanitarian and medical crisis there that is the direct result of the administration's inhumanity and degrading position with regard to children. And perhaps it comes as no surprise that over the past year, 7 children have died in federal immigration custody after almost a decade where no child was reported as dying while in the custody of Customs and Border Protection.
I was going to ask what the federal government needs to do to address overcrowding, but I almost want to say who will hold the United States government accountable for these, what appear to be violations of the Flores Agreement and or even human rights violations, quite frankly. Laura.
Many people have reached out to me concerned about the conditions in Clint since the story broke last week. I'm asking everyone to demand immediate congressional hearings on the appalling conditions at the border. I'm asking folks to please support nonprofit organizations that try to help meet the daily needs of those crossing the border, as well as provide free legal services to individuals. I'm asking that knowledge and awareness about this crisis be shared, because I think regardless of one's party affiliation or political background, we can all agree that children need to be taken care of in conditions that meet basic human decency. When Vice President Pence was interviewed yesterday on CNN, he was asked whether immigrant children deserve soap and toothbrushes while they are in these detention centers. And his response was, of course.
Laura Mukherjee is the director of the Immigrants' Right Clinic at Columbia Law, and David Hernandez is an associate professor of Latino Studies at Mount Holyoke College. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Takeaway reached out to Customs and Border Protection for comment on this story, and a CBP official sent us a response that said the agency uses what it described as, quote, limited resources to provide the best possible care for the people they detain, especially children. And they said these facilities were not meant to hold vulnerable populations long term, and they're calling on Congress to provide more funding. You can find the rest of their statement on our website, thetakeaway.org. Mayor Pete Buttigieg was supposed to be on the campaign trail in South Carolina on Friday. Instead, he was back home in South Bend, Indiana, facing protesters who were angry over his response to the June 16th killing of Eric Logan.
Did you just ask me if Black Lives Matter?
Yes, we want to hear you say.
Of course, Black Lives Matter.
Then fire your car!
Logan, who is Black, was shot and killed by a white police officer after being found breaking into parked cars, according to officials. He did not have a gun, but police say he had a knife. The officer who shot Logan, South Bend Sergeant Ryan O'Neill, did not switch on his body camera, and now members of the community are demanding answers about what prompted Logan's death. Oliver Davis is a South Bend Common Councilman serving the 6th District, and he's watched as tensions between the African-American community, the largely white police force, and the mayor's office have escalated over the years. Councilman Davis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
Before we get into the details of how the mayor is handling the situation, can you give us a sense of what the latest is on the investigation into Eric Logan's death?
Currently, everything's at the prosecutor's office, and that's being handled there. That's our understanding. Where we are as a city council is at our council meeting. We will be sending individual letters to our local prosecutor asking for a special investigation into the Eric Logan matter. Because of many of the uprisings that is going on in town, there's a lack of trust.
And talking a little bit more about that lack of trust, and more is emerging now from reporters who are familiar with the region about the relationships between the police and the Black community in South Bend. Can you give us a sense, is this a new phenomenon, or have these tensions always existed?
This is my 12th year on the council. And a lot of the tensions that started with this particular situation started back in 2012, right in the middle of a Trayvon Martin rally that was being held here in South Bend. I received a phone call on that Thursday back in 2012 that our police chief, who was an African-American male, who was highly respected, not only in the African-American communities here in South Bend, but throughout our whole entire community, had just been fired. And so I made a phone call over to the mayor to confirm that. And he told me, well, I guess the cat's out the bag. And we had over 200 people that showed up in protest of that. And we started to ask for an investigation to this matter. In fact, we said that the South Bend Common Council is going to subpoena the police tapes. We had some officers talk about some racial actions that were going on in the police department on tapes. And they then said that we could not hear them. And so it's been a legal battle for the last 7 years. Mayor Pete Buttigieg sued the council, and we have been held up in court for the last 7 years. As a legislative branch, we believe that we can subpoena according to state rules. And Mayor Pete talks about some of that in his book, The Shortest Way Home. We believe that that really started to build the distrust between him and those of us in the community because of how he handled it. He has a right to choose who he wants to in terms of his offices. But the way he went about debasing, degrading Chief Boykins had a sour taste in many of our mouths.
Mayor Pete held a town hall in South Bend on Sunday. I'd like to play a clip from that town hall and hear your reaction to that.
The effort to recruit more minority officers to the police department and the effort to introduce body cameras have not succeeded. And I accept responsibility for that.
Councilman Davis, can you talk a little bit about Mayor Pete's response there, or his comments there? And more broadly, was he able to address the concerns of the Black community in South Bend?
No, he was not. Because of we all did a resolution asking for more diversity within the South Bend Police Department back in December of 2004. And that has not happened. In fact, it's continually to decrease. And in a city with the diversity that is found in South Bend, to have basically about less than 5% of the police force African-American is a disgrace. We have close to 30% of this town that's African-American. And to say that, well, we can't find anybody, or people are not signing up, or they drop in the middle of an interview and they don't complete their interview, is something that we must not accept.
there were protests on Friday in South Bend, and a couple of tense moments emerged in those protests between Mayor Pete and Black community members. He was asked specifically if Black Lives Matter. He answered, of course, Black Lives Matter. What was the response to that answer? Was that satisfactory?
There's a lot of words that are being said, but actions speak louder than words. There's a saying that if you don't practice what you preach is only a speech and it won't reach. And that's the challenge that we have. Is his speech reaching various communities? Not only were African-Americans in that crowd, there were many of our white community that was in that crowd screaming also.
There are people who would say that the criticism of Mayor Pete right now is not fair, that he left the campaign trail, has made an effort to respond to the needs of the community, has held a town hall, has embraced, if you will, the language of Black Lives Matter. What's your response to that? Is this a temporary moment for Mayor Pete, and will he be able to recover?
Well, the challenge of running for president as a mayor is not the easiest challenge. You can see that in Mayor de Blasio in New York. And the challenges he's had in gaining traction. And so mayors have a unique challenge that the United States senators or Congress officers do not have to deal with. And even in this whole crisis, nobody's calling on Senator Young or our Senator Brom to deal with this. These are issues that local politicians, local city council, local mayors have to deal with. And this is where the rubber meets the road down here at the local politics. Tip O'Neill said it, all politics is local. And many of the actions that we as local officials have to make, the national officials do, and federal officials don't have to deal with that. Many of them can raise their own families in Washington, D.C., and Virginia, Maryland area, even though they're senators. We have to live within our districts. We go to our barbershops, our churches, our beauty shops, our communities, where as soon as we make a decision, we hear the effects of that on our way home.
Oliver Davis is the South Bend Common Councilman serving the city's 6th District. Councilman Davis, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. If you've been watching the Women's World Cup, you may have noticed a controversial theme.
The VAR team checking for a possible penalty.
It is something that can be reviewed with VAR.
They are actually checking for a possible offense.
So we'll do it again.
VAR, short for Video Assistant Referee, is soccer's version of instant replay for the officials. It's the first time VAR has been used in a major women's tournament, and it's already been involved in several crucial moments. Take Sunday, when the goal that would have put host country France ahead of Brazil in the first knockout stage was disallowed for a foul on the goalkeeper.
And here we go. No goal. Not given.
You can hear the boos there from the French crowd. And earlier that day, Cameroon had a goal called back against England for being narrowly offsides. And the team was so upset over the ruling that they refused to play for several minutes while their captain spoke with the referee. All this has got fans and analysts thinking about how instant replay should be used in the sport and whether it should be used at all. Ricardo Salazar knows something about this. In 2017, he became the first referee to use video replay in a game in Major League Soccer here in the U.S. He's now a video assistant referee for the officiating organization that services the MLS. Ricardo, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Shireen Ahmed, sports writer and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Shireen, it's always great to have you on.
Thanks, Tanzina. Hi, Ricardo.
Hi. How are you?
So, Shireen, let's get started. What most concerns you about how video replay has affected this World Cup?
Well, first of all, I'm going to try to be very nuanced and unbiased in my commentary.
Fair.
But one of the things is, and I can defer all the technical stuff to Ricardo, but one of the things is the lack of consistency to which the rule has been applied, namely the goalkeeping rule, which, you know, IFAB, the governing federation of FIFA that governs over rules and policies, they've changed it so that now the goalkeeping rule where goalkeepers were actually given a yellow if they came off the line has now been changed. So only during regulation time, not in extra time, not in penalty kicks, they won't be given it or booked with a yellow. So, I mean, right away we see that this entire process was used, while many feel, including myself, like they used the women's tournament as a guinea pig to see how it would be applied. And most important point is these rules were put into play 5 days before the Women's World Cup started. That's not enough time to train everybody adequately. From what I understand, the officials only got 6 months. And the players, are they going to be expected to like change, particularly the goalkeepers, their actual visceral movements? Like it's bizarre and hasn't been consistently applied. And it's actually giving us less faith in the officials on the pitch.
And Ricardo, you were one of those officials. Let's talk about, we know that instant replay is something that's used in referees in all types of sports. Why? What's different in VAR and soccer?
Well, it can only be used like any sport, it can only be used in a set scenarios, four set scenarios. As you can tell, when a goal is scored, and that's what we're seeing here, when a goal is scored, whether penalty kick or no penalty kick, with a direct red card and a mistaken identity. And these occasions, the video assistant referee always checks. When a play has happened and people are up in arms, it's being checked. And that's something that players, fans, spectators, managers, people who have any interest in a game need to understand that it's always being checked. And it's multiple camera angles, and we're there to assist the referee, video assistant referee. That's his main objective, is to assist the referee at all times to make sure he gets the right decision.
Ricardo, you were the first referee to use video replay to overturn one of your own calls. Tell me about that moment.
Well, yeah, it was a historic day when we rolled this out in Major League Soccer. We in Major League Soccer worked many years leading up to that day. We rolled it out, 2 years leading up to it. We had a lot of practice, a lot of scenarios we ran through, a lot of seminars we went to. And that historic day means one thing and one thing only, that I, on the day, made a mistake. So nobody likes to make mistakes, but we're fortunate that we had video review that day as a safety net to correct that decision on the field and get the decision right.
Shireen, before the break, you mentioned that VAR, at least in this World Cup, has sort of been used as a guinea pig for the Women's World Cup. But it was used in the Men's World Cup last year, and it also faced some controversy then. What's different between now and then?
Well, first of all, like I said, the implementation of this was done just days before the tournament began. That wasn't sufficient time for teams to, you know, talk about it, understand it. And secondly, like the way that the reactions to it have been, like I said, they've, like IFAB on June 21st released a statement saying they're going to change the way that it was implemented, which is bizarre. And I mean, I understand that VAR is there to assist the officials, but the problem is, and that I'm seeing of all these matches that I'm watching, and I am, again, no technical expert on that. I'm a player, not an official. Is so much that even smaller calls are being deferred to VAR. And that's one of the problems I have, it because it like effectively loses the flow and the dynamism of what's happening on the pitch. If everything is being called, it ends up being like, oh my gosh, like American football, and which is choppy, and it ruins the flow of the game. And the other thing is that it becomes a very tense situation, very, very tense, in that, you know, do you celebrate or you don't celebrate? I mean, one of my biggest complaints with VR is that it's killing my live tweeting of the matches, but that's just my own thing. But it's almost like the visceral reactions that everybody has are on pause. And even for smaller things, like I understand if it's an attack on the net and, you know, a forward is coming out, like we saw yesterday, Brazil versus France, we saw Gauvin go up against Barbara, and, you know, we saw that, and that was important in that moment. But for smaller things, and when it's just like a hairline off or offside, this is one of the problems with it. Like, those who are in the VAR assessment room, who are they? How are they making their decisions? How do they come to those decisions? So what it does is it opens up a Pandora box of more questions. Whereas previously, the culture of soccer was very much, what happens if the ref sees it? you know, I'm not saying it's the greatest thing, but it's what everybody is used to. So it's going to take time, and that time was effectively not given for the Women's World Cup.
Ricardo, I'd love to get your thoughts on that, because a couple things. Is VAR, in your estimation, sort of regulating the game, the spirit out of the game in many ways?
You know, the whole idea behind the video review system is minimal interference, maximum benefit, and that's our objective here. And I believe, so it's my own personal feeling here, that the world, the people who have interest in our beautiful game, have to embrace this. And I know it's not easy. Another point being, as Shireen had mentioned, the guinea pig, the women being the guinea pig, there currently isn't, that I'm aware of, any domestic leagues that women have video review. So it's very new to the women's game. Although on the men's side, globally, there are many domestic leagues, ours being just one of several, that have implemented video review and were able to work out the kinks and get that consistency to where it's palatable.
And Ricardo, just, I mean, I guess the big question is, you know, beyond sort of the culture and the natural rhythm of the game, is there are people who are saying that this is being used for calls that are not clear and obvious errors, that it's, again, being overused in some ways. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, the video review system's not bulletproof. You know, we on the field make mistakes, and that's one of the hardest things that we have to take away on game day, is when we don't get something right. And again, you hit it on the head. It's supposed to be for clear and obvious. And sometimes the person in the booth, you know, they got that gut feeling, you know, do I get involved? Do I not get involved? Where's the bar? You know, do I want to get involved here? And sometimes we don't make the best decisions, and we have to live with that. We're human. But when all the information, all the technology is there for us, we hope we come away with the best decision on the day.
Shireen, your thoughts on that? I mean, do you think that ultimately the VAR should be scrapped altogether, which it doesn't sound like that's going to happen? Or is there a way to improve the technology or the implementation of the technology to both, to Ricardo's point, to make better calls, but also to your point, to not ruin the sort of flow, the natural flow of the game?
Yeah, I really, really appreciate what Ricardo said about not being in any of the domestic leagues in the world, and that's very important. This wasn't given time to grow and to be sort of implemented in a way that felt organic. It doesn't feel organic at all. It feels like VAR is this enemy of the beautiful game, and it's crushing all of our hopes and dreams, and that's not what it's meant to be. I am no way against VAR in that sense, but I don't like the way it was implemented here. And I totally agree with what Ricardo's saying, is that there needs to be time to learn. And from what I understand, with in terms of the international refs for the men's side, they were given almost 2 years to train with this. We're seeing a big disparity in the level of officiating in terms of how it's being implemented, and that's one of the problems. I don't even think some of the officials themselves seem to be familiar with it, and that's what bothers me. And then the players essentially and supporters lose faith, because it's like, for very small calls, that's what's happening, and it's supposed to assist, not sort of relegate and decide and be this thing. And I'm all for justice on the pitch, whatever that looks like. I mean, that's another topic for another day. But this doesn't feel like it's applied and supporting in that form of fairness.
Shireen Ahmed is a sports writer and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. And Ricardo Salazar is a longtime referee for FIFA and the MLS, and now a video assistant referee for the officiating organization that services the MLS. Shireen, Ricardo, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know why I survived all those overdoses, but I plan on helping as many people as I can.
I think we can't define success as just a decrease in the number of people dying.
I've cried over it. I mean, over people I don't even know.
I think that all my friends are dead, and the ones that aren't found recovery.
Ohio has one of the highest rates of opioid overdose deaths in the country. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, in 2017, more than 4,000 people died of an opioid overdose in the state. That's 2.5 times the national average. It's become a public health crisis that's left the state scrambling to respond. But some cities in Ohio have been successful in combating the crisis. partly because of expanded availability of naloxone, or Narcan, the so-called overdose reversal drug. And that means more people are living after an overdose. But the big question is, what comes next for those people? This week, you'll hear from two women we met in Ohio. Both survived opioid overdoses in the last year, and each shares their story of overdose and what came after. It's a series we're calling Life After Overdose. The Takeaway's Alexandra Boti brings us the first piece of the story.
I'm in Dayton, Ohio, in the western part of the state. Here, everybody knows the Melody Diner. I'm meeting 25-year-old April Arian and her mom, Lori.
My name is Lori Arian. I'm a person in long-term recovery from my substance use disorder. And what that means is I haven't had a drink or drug for almost 13 years.
I'm April. I'm her daughter. I've been struggling with my own addiction since I was 16, so that's almost 10 years.
This is Montgomery County, a part of the state that's been one of the hardest hit by the opioid crisis, and also the county with the biggest success story. Overdose deaths have plummeted here, down almost 50% between 2017 and 2018. That's thanks to things like Medicaid expansion in the state, more cooperation between police and community organizations, and less carfentanil on the street. That's a deadly synthetic opioid. But April, who was in active addiction when we spoke, told me she's not really seeing those changes.
For me, I have Narcan. A lot of people, I have like a lot of PTSD from it. From people going blue.
About half of people struggling with drug addiction will overdose and survive at least once. Even more will witness an overdose by someone else. April's experience giving Narcan to her friends is why she knew exactly what had happened to her when she recently overdosed. It was the first time someone had needed to save her life.
But so when I woke up and I saw like that the room was trashed and my purse was turned upside down and there was somebody in front of me that was crying and like looking like really like just like scared and panicked, and he was like white as a ghost. Like I knew what had happened, but like most people, I think when they wake up in an overdose, they don't really know what has happened, but only because I had seen it so many times. Like did I realize that my purse was turned over and everything was thrown everywhere because he was looking for the Narcan. He was trying to get it out of the box. He was trying to get it out of the package. He was trying to get it into my body. He was moving me, trying to do chest compressions on me. My chest hurt when I woke up. And I was just really scared, and I was really sick. I think that was the first thing that I said after I was crying for like over 15 minutes straight. And I said I was sick, and he asked me what I wanted, and I said I didn't know. And he asked me if I wanted more dope, but I just was like, no. Because I knew that it would go away. But it like doesn't go away when you keep using and you start waking up sick. But that was like the first moment of like clarity I've probably like ever had in my whole addiction where I thought about it like that. So, I don't know.
As the opioid epidemic exploded in the US, Narcan, the brand name for the drug naloxone, became a first line of defense against deaths. The drug is available without a prescription in 46 states currently, including across Ohio. Here, you can find Narcan at Walgreens. Police officers in your neighborhood are likely to have it on hand in their cars. And free trainings on how to use Narcan are everywhere.
I was laying in bed one night asking myself, what can I do to help her? And it came to me, give her all the Narcan you have.
Lori, April's mom, is the founder of a group called Families of Addicts, based out of Dayton. Families of Addicts provides free Narcan trainings. At a recent meeting, Lori got a refill of Narcan and gave it to April.
And I'm pretty sure that's the Narcan that saved her life.
Yeah, that was the Narcan you used on me.
Yeah, it might have been helpful if I would have taken it out of the plastic bag and out of the box and all that, but nonetheless, she had it.
I know a lot of people think that addicts are out here running around with Narcan and thinking that they can, you know, use more or use anyway because they're going to be Narcan, quote, back to life. But in my experience, it's not like that at all. People that I use with, like, beg people not to Narcan them before they use. They'll say, you know, don't Narcan me if I go out because once you get Narcan, you're really sick. I mean, deathly sick.
But the physical experience of overdose is just one piece of this story.
I've experienced some guilt over it, you know, some shame.
4 hours northeast of Dayton is the Women's Recovery Center in the Stockyard neighborhood of Cleveland.
Hi there. Hi, I'm Alex.
I'm here with Lauren Hamilton.
I'm 41 years old.
Today, Lauren is a practicing attorney, and Cleveland is her home city. Here, opioid overdose deaths declined about 20% between 2017 and 2018. But it's complicated. Many more people are still dying than before the crisis took hold here, and officials are worried about a recent spike in fentanyl mixed with crack cocaine.
Over the course of, I guess, 3 years, I overdosed 11 times.
Lauren remembers some of those 11 overdoses more clearly than others, like the very first.
I remember waking up. The first overdose, the police broke into my house and found me about 18 hours after I had overdosed. So I didn't respond to Narcan. My blood pressure was like 50 over 20. My kidneys had shut down and my lung had collapsed. So I was in a coma for 3 days, I believe. I was in intensive care for 5 days. And I remember waking up in intensive care. And my family had no idea at that point that I was even using these drugs. And, you know, they were all around me. And it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying.
3 years later, Lauren overdosed again. After using heroin, she was revived with Narcan by police.
I was laying on a stretcher at Metro Health Hospital in the emergency room. And they, you know, they didn't put me in a room. They just had me laying on a stretcher in the hallway. And a police officer was standing across the room, and I saw him make eye contact with me, and he walked across the room and leaned down so he was at the level of the stretcher, looked me in the eye, and told me that I was junkie scum and that I should be taken off or put on the do not Narcan list. You know, that moment to be disrespected by another human being like that, what he said to me and the, you know, the message that he was conveying to me, that is how I felt. That's how I felt about myself. You know, and to realize that that's how other people saw me as well just wasn't a good feeling.
The stigma of overdose is something I heard about again and again when traveling the state.
I've cried over it, you know. I mean, over people I don't even know. It's absolutely horrible. I think about people who have overdosed and died who have children. I don't have any children. I think about people who overdosed, you know, maybe just having used heroin a couple times. But ultimately, you know, we're all in the same boat. We're all the same, and I'm just grateful to be here.
That was The Takeaways, Alexandra Boti reporting from Ohio. We'll hear more of Lauren and April's stories of life after overdose and about Ohio's fight against opioids over the next few days. You can find the series at thetakeaway.org/lifeafteroverdose. And that's all for us today. Remember, you can listen back to anything on our podcasts, and you can find that on Spotify or iTunes or at thetakeaway.org. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.